is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We are Zooming this on actually Thursday morning, so if something should happen Thursday night, we'll be discussing it on Monday. As you've come to expect, we begin every show, as we have for months, with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. We will continue to do that between now and Election Day. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Well, if it's Friday, we make the schlep to Texas. And who do we grab? We grab Scott Braddock. He's the editor of the Quam Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps, and someone who has taught me so much about Texas geography, Texas politics, Texas history. I actually feel like I know more about Texas than my home state of New York, which is where I was born. Mm-hmm. You're now competing with what I know about the place that I wanted to be governor, which is the state of New Hampshire. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for sort of sharing so much about this great state, which really is, I think, a reflection of what our future may look like. Because as we see the changing demographic in Texas, as we look at climate change and what that means both for Texas from an economic perspective because of oil and because we're looking at maybe other alternatives like wind and solar, Texas really, I think, is a reflection of where we're going to be as a nation. So following Texas is important for my audience. So let me welcome you to the program. And the first thing I have to ask, obviously, because we're Zooming this on Thursday morning, is we both stayed up to watch the debate. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of curious as to your reaction, having both of us been radio talk show hosts, both of us being commercial radio talk show hosts.
Yeah.
I've met Mike Pence. Mm-hmm. I've been on the air with Mike Pence. I could have described Mike Pence's performance in my sleep because it is very typical of a conservative radio talk show host. There was no surprises, I think, from his performance last night.
No surprises, and a lot of people were focused on the vice president going overtime and sort of bulldozing both Senator Harris and the moderator. That's the chattering class saying that. I always think, Arnie, that when those sorts of arguments break out about the stuff that normal people don't care about, I was asking the question online last night whether the line was working when Senator Harris was saying, "I'm speaking." When she said, "I'm speaking," I think the first time that probably hit a certain way, and then maybe when she said it again and again, it, I don't know if it lost its effect. Maybe not. I heard from some women who said, if you've ever been talked over in a meeting by a man, you were on your feet cheering whenever she said, "I'm speaking." They would love to hear a woman say that. As for Pence, he's got a softer touch, as somebody described him, he's sort of the velvet hammer. He's a little more diplomatic in the way he handles things, and I would say, to Pence's credit, he has the ability to articulate what Donald Trump just can't do. He's sort of the cleanup crew after Trump just, you know, makes a mess everywhere last week, verbally vomits all over the stage last week.
He's a much more effective liar. He's a much more effective liar.
One thing that really bothers me, and maybe one reason that, and as you saw this morning, as we tape on Thursday, early this morning, the news came out that the Commission on Presidential Debates says they're going to have a virtual debate next. President Trump had said that he would not do that. I'm not sure what's going to happen there. If he just won't do it, I don't know what happens if the other candidate just won't do the debate. We'll see what happens. Maybe that can be a little more controlled. As you know, Arnie, as we talked about after the debate last week, I thought it was great. I thought it was an expose for just normal people, who Trump really is. Most people probably only because you and I do this all the time. We're watching what Trump is saying and what he's tweeting and what he's putting out online and what he says from the White House. And we watch the press conferences and everything like that because this is our job. This is what we do. Right. We live and breathe and eat politics. Most people are probably exposed to 2 or 3 minutes of Trump per day, if that. Yeah. But when they saw a feature-length film worth of him being a jerk for 90 minutes, people didn't like that. And the polls showed, and I don't think this poll was out last time we talked, the polls showed that even his own supporters, a full third of Trump supporters said they did not like his performance in that debate. They were turned off by it. I heard about some people here in Texas out of the yard. They didn't like that. So they weren't necessarily flipping over to support Biden, but they were not wanting to be associated with President Trump after that. Some of the weak-kneed liberals start to say, oh, Biden shouldn't stand there on that stage with that jerk. I'm like, that's the exact reason to stand on the stage with him so that exactly. everybody can see that the man is a jerk. But as for last night, you know, I thought that Pence did a really good job of articulating what the president was simply unable to, phrase it however you like, that he's a good liar or whatever. I don't know that Senator Harris came across as the kind of competent prosecutor that I know that she is. Maybe they've said that you shouldn't do that, that you shouldn't necessarily be so prosecutorial.
I think she was on Kamala because she was basically being
I think that's a mistake. I think that that's her strength. Right. Yeah, what's your thought?
So it's interesting. That was the active discussion I had last weekend when we had Stefan Schmidt on our Rethink the Week. Stefan suggested that she should not be aggressive, that she should not take out, he used the term stiletto. I'm not sure I would use that term because someone's aggressive. And I got very upset because I agree with you. I think it doesn't play to her strength when you don't allow her to use her prosecutorial skills. And one of the things that was frustrating for me, I think she did a competent job. There's no question about it. But one of the things that I think I would have done is over and over again, not only did Pence abuse the rules. I mean, I've never heard someone say, you know what the rules are, you know what the rules are. And I felt so bad for the moderator because she couldn't like shut off his mic. You know, and he kept, you know, just plowing through. But he didn't answer the question that was being asked. He never answered the question that was being asked.
It's so disrespectful.
What I would have done is, after it came to me.
As somebody who's done these debates before, Arnie.
You know, that was a very nice answer, Vice President Pence, but not to the question that was asked. Right. So let me do this for you. I will answer the question, as you probably know, is the answer from the Trump administration. And then I will answer the question. I would have made a point of doing that over and over again. Instead of just saying, it's my turn, I want to speak, I would have made a point of making sure that people understood the question that was asked was not the question that was answered.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what else. As somebody who has moderated just a ton of debates over the years, going back to when I was in my mid-20s, I was doing congressional debates down in Houston. The most disrespectful thing that someone will do, and I get that people want to follow up on stuff, when you move on to the next topic and the person, and Pence did this last night, it says, I want to go back and talk about that other topic. Like, we're done with that. Why are you doing that? You know, the other candidate isn't doing that. I think that Senator Harris did a sort of a version of that, but I would give her a little more leeway on it because when it was brought up later in the debate, he had talked about her record as a prosecutor. Right. And she said, well, I should at least get to be able to respond for 30 seconds because he talked about my record. I should be able to respond to that. They gave her a quick moment to respond. I do think that, Arnie, all these rules and debates, and I had a young Democrat text last night and ask how I would have handled this because they know that I've moderated lots of debates over the years. How would you prevent them from interrupting each other? I said I wouldn't. All of these rules are silly. The rules are more about the campaigns than they are about ideas and the audience. Anytime that these debates would play out, and I've been involved in lots of them, as I said, anytime the candidates are really mixing it up, that's the part the audience likes. They kind of want you to step back and let them and let the candidates do that. Let them moderate each other for just a little bit, and then you step in and sort of get the discussion going again and move the discussion along. I think that this strict adherence to you get to talk for 2 minutes, then you get to talk to 2 minutes, and then you get, and then we'll talk for 6 minutes. It's like nobody cares about all that. You've got 90 minutes. Just have a discussion. Right. Have an open and frank discussion. Good moderating is about that. It's about letting the candidates expose themselves for who they are. And then there's so much is going to be said during these things. You can't fact check it all on the fly. There's no way to do that. But there's an army of fact checkers ready to go during the thing. They're online during the thing and they're online afterwards. Watch for that stuff.
Let me just say something, Scott.
As much as they'll hang themselves with some of these lies, believe me, that will come out.
Well, I mean, I think one of the most telling moments was when they were asked the question about whether Trump would leave if he lost the election, about the transition. And what did Pence do? He never answered that question.
And
he turned to Obamacare.
Yeah.
He turned to Obamacare. I'm screaming at the television set going, excuse me? excuse me. So let me just say one thing. I also have moderated lots of debates. I've also interviewed lots of candidates. And I remember interviewing a Democratic candidate, and I asked this candidate a series of questions. He was running for Congress. He basically did not answer anything. Every answer was obtuse, non-specific. It was evasive. At the end of the half an hour, he said to me, "How did I do?" I said, "You did so well at not answering. You will never appear on this program again." That was my response. I just want people to know I'm a jerk all the time, but I want you to learn something, and being evasive is not good for me, and it's not good for the audience.
I try to tell them I'm trying to help them. I'll say, I'm sure that's an answer to some question, just not the one I asked. Or I'll say something along the lines of, you know, I didn't ask you about that or anything like it. Here's what my question was, and just come right back around to it. I don't like this where they don't actually respond to what was said.
Right. Let's get into what's going on in Texas.
Oh, I'm happy
to. I did see this decision this morning. You write, I'm so glad, the Texas Supreme Court made some quick decisions on voting rules in Texas.
Yeah.
One good, one bad.
Yeah.
We'll explain. I think the good one is they supported the governor in early voting. Is that the good one?
The one that expands the franchise is we have early voting starting next week for 3 weeks in Texas. Normally we get 2 weeks in Texas. The governor's trying to thread the needle. He always middles himself, Arnie.
I know.
So you have the Democrats. That's what we say around here. He middles himself. The Democrats, of course, want to expand mail-in voting as an option for just about everybody in Texas, for every eligible voter. The Republicans are not for that, right? They just want to keep it for the people who are 65 plus, which is current Texas law. The governor, is siding with Republicans on that. But he was sued by members of his own party because he expanded early voting for 3 weeks. The chairman of the Texas Republican Party, Alan West, the former Florida congressman, some call him Florida Man, he sued the governor over this expansion of early voting, saying that the governor unilaterally did that and he didn't have the authority to do that. So the Texas Supreme Court, which I believe four of the justices were appointed by Abbott, I had a feeling they would go his way on that.
May I ask a question? How was it argued? Because you let me just say, you actually said that you thought that Abbott was on thin ice with this.
Mm-hmm.
That he really didn't have the authority to do this. So I'm kind of curious, how did the Texas Supreme Court thread the needle, or did they just not offer an opinion and just say it's okay?
Threading the needle is exactly the right way to say it. In the ruling, what the justices came up with, there was only one dissenting opinion. The justices basically argued that the people who sued the governor waited too long to do that. And this is actually a legal argument. The Fifth Circuit, in a different case, basically sided with the argument that when you are on the eve of the election, you can't be changing the rules around, right? People need to have some expectation for what the rules are. In a different case that had to do with undoing the repeal of straight ticket voting in Texas, the Fifth Circuit hasn't fully ruled on the merits of that, but they did stay a case out of South Texas. And what they said was, basically, you can't go changing the rules this close to the election. And the election's happening now. Military and those absentee ballots are already out. Early voting is right about to start. People are getting their mail ballots in the mail if they are able to vote that way. You know, we're going. We're blowing and going now. You can't, in the middle of the election, just rule against now.
Well, that's consistent with what the Supreme Court just did on South Carolina. They claimed that they couldn't change the rules, yada, yada, yada. Although the Supreme Court then just changed the rules. But we won't go there. Okay, so that one. What's the bad decision?
The Democratic county clerk in Harris County, which is home to 1/5 of the Texas electorate, he wanted to be able to send mail-in ballot applications, not the ballots, but the applications, to the 2.4 million eligible voters in Harris County. The Republicans sued against the county clerk there. They said that he can't do that, that he is overstepping his authority, and the justices, the all-Republican Supreme Court, sided with the Republican argument on that and said that the Democrat could not go ahead and send out those applications. So that does indeed, I think, restrict the vote of a lot of people in the most populous county in Texas. Now, in a separate case, which is in federal court, and there are more arguments to come on this, even this week, and think about this, Arnie, they're arguing in court with just days to go before people are going to literally walk and go to the polling places all across Texas. October 13th is when the early voting starts. They're still litigating this now. And we talk about, changing the rules. In this other case, and this gets a little nuanced, but I think it's important. The governor, in his earlier decrees about the election, had said that if somebody gets a mail-in ballot and they want to be able to go drop it off in person, why would people want to do that? Republicans will say, how about just drop it in the box in front of your house? It's called your mailbox. It's a mail ballot. Okay, well, you can do it that way, but you do have a Republican president who has been muddying the water about whether or not the mail ballots are even going to get to elections administrators on time to be able to count them, right? And we've seen all this with the interference at the post office and all of that. You've covered it here on the show. So some people want the option to be able to fill in the ballot and go down to a site and drop it off in a box without having to go inside. I think that's reasonable during a pandemic. Well, the governor said that they can do that, but there can only be one location for people to do that per county in Texas. This comes right back to Harris County, and Harris County could be pivotal in this whole thing. I think that it may well be. The county clerk there had said that he wanted to set up 11 sites all over the county. Harris County is 2,000 square miles, Arnie. If you live in the suburban part of the county and you're only allowed to have one box to go drop off that mail ballot, if you were in certain parts of the county, you'd have to drive 40 or 50 miles round trip to be able to go do that. This potentially will make some Republicans angry, because I can tell you that in Harris County, right in the urban center, right in the city of Houston, you're looking at a more Democratic and more progressive population. But Harris County is geographically very big, and so it does have places that are just legit suburbs within Harris County, places like Humble, Texas, Cyfair, Texas, Katy, Texas. And if you're there and you're thinking, I have to drive all the way into Houston and back to be able to do it, that's going to aggravate some of those suburban women who want to be able to take advantage of that option, and some others who might tend to lean more toward the Republican side. I would have to assume that the governor has seen some internal polling, you know, they do the best polling, the Republicans have the money to do that, that those who would want to take advantage of this option probably lean toward the Democrats. And so they're trying to suppress those votes. And you sent me a story this morning from The Hill. I'm glad they noticed that we have voter suppression in Texas. All of these different fights that are happening based on various little parts, little quirks of Texas election law, which does make it, as compared to some other states, makes it harder to vote. And you have a lot of new voters, Arnie. Let me tell you about a conversation I had with a 19-year-old first-time voter. Her name is Carolyn Braddock, my daughter. We were talking about the election, and she wants to be able to, you know, have her voice heard and all that. Well, we were talking about voting. Arnie, voting is confusing to people who have never done it before, right? So when I said, you know, what's the plan? Are we going to go, you know, I'll take you first day of early voting if that's what you want to do. And she said, without missing a beat, she goes, I already voted. I said, what are you talking about? She goes, I voted early. I said, you mean you voted in March in the primary? I had to explain to her that that wasn't the election. How many young people don't know that, Arnie? All of this stuff has to be explained. So when people don't know that, and you know, went through the process of talking to her about, you know, how that all works. If people don't know that, and then there's all these headlines of the, you know, the confusion and you know, the tumult that's out there. It's like flak being thrown up in the air about, you know, what the rules are for voting. With a lot of people, the more difficult it sounds, the less likely they're even. I mean, just forget about somebody going to the polling place and being turned away. All of this confusion in and of itself is a form of voter suppression, right? Because people don't know what they're, it's intentional. People don't know what they're supposed to do, and so they're less likely to go do it. You know, this concern about mail ballots is just from the, you know, not from the fraud standpoint, that people will mess it up, you know, when they're filling out the form. They may not
they
do
don't
it
notice,
right.
They may not sign twice. They may not,
might
they
not
may
sign it
right
twice
envelope.
Or whatever, right. So there's right. all kinds of opportunity for things to just be messed up, even if people don't do it, you know, anything nefarious.
I don't know if this is happening in Texas, but it's happening in Concord, New Hampshire. And in Concord, New Hampshire, I just got a bunch of people calling me going, did you know that they've changed where we can vote in Ward 2 or Ward 4 or Ward 5 or whatever? So they're actually changing the geographic location. So even if you want to vote in person on election day, you have historically gone to, you know, the church basement, or you've gone to some place that you've done forever. Well, it's turned out that they decided to relocate because of the pandemic, because they can't social distance as effectively. And the question then becomes, well, when do they tell me that this is happening? How are they sharing this with the community? Where is that new location if I don't know where it is? I mean, again, on top of who can vote, how they vote, absentee, you know, vote by mail, vote by, you know, putting it into a Dropbox. I mean, this is not only the most confusing election, but people who have even developed a muscle for voting a certain way are being told, oh, by the way, that's changed too.
The hearing on all that with the drop-off boxes, that's later today or tomorrow. So they're still trying to figure that out as we go into early voting next week.
I want to talk about the bars and COVID. I saw two stories that I needed to juxtapose. One is, you write that the GOP protests against Governor Abbott's continued after he says to counties around the state that they can decide whether to allow bars to reopen amid the pandemic. So county by county, there are hundreds of counties in Texas. So it's sort of an accident of geography whether a bar is open. Mm-hmm. I am reading about the bars opening as I'm reading this, I'm reading about football shutting down because of COVID. Mm-hmm. There's a connection between bars open and football in high school. And the reason that is that what we know is that bars are probably the biggest super spreader opportunity in any community in the state. And if you want your kid to play football, well, guess what? The first thing you probably need to do is shut down the damn bars, because they are the essence of super spreaders. And so I'm looking at these two stories and I'm going, oh my God, connect the dots, people. You love your kids, you love your high school, you love your football, but they're not going to be able to play football if you continue to open bars.
Well, the governor wants, he's punting on a difficult decision. He's done it throughout the pandemic. An interesting nuance, Arnie, in traveling around the state, I was in Houston, I'm heading back to Dallas later today. As you go around to various businesses, people are being told to wear the mask. Certain places are open. They can be open at different levels of capacity. They can be open at 50% or 75% based on what the governor had said. One of the consequences of the governor at first leaving everything up to the local officials, remember, he left the tough decisions to shut things down to county judges and to mayors around the state, to anybody other than himself. They had to make the hard decisions. But then when what he thought would be the politically popular thing to open some things back up, he took that on himself to do that. And he said that mayors and county judges did not have any authority. He's being selective about when the local officials have authority to do things, which people, both Democrats and Republicans, have described as tyrannical. Because anytime he thinks it's going to be, you know, difficult decision, he lets other people make the decision. So when you go to these businesses, Arnie, on the doors, it will say, there'll be a sign on the door that says, by local mandate or local order, you have to wear a mask when you come in here. The governor of Texas made the decision that you have to wear the mask or face a fine of $250. We saw the governor's approval rating in this state go from 70% down to 35% for his coronavirus response in about 6 weeks. Just a collapse that is epic. How much lower would his approval rating be if those signs said, by order of the governor of Texas, you have to wear a mask when you come in here? By order of the governor of Texas, this business is closed. Right. Those signs don't say that. And the things that are eye level for people, people aren't seeing that in real time. They're hearing about it on the news, and they're very upset with the things that he's doing. But in this case, the governor is saying, well, if the county judge wants to opt in and say the bars can be open in their county, then they can do that. But as was pointed out to me, the governor has laid out very specific regulations or rules for how those bars can be open. I know we don't have time to get into all of them,
but nobody's doing it.
Well, some of them will do it. The only option he's giving is that the county judge can either say yes or no to the rules that he is coming up with, rather than let them figure out what's good in their communities. It's a total joke.
All right, really quick. Your attorney general, your indicted attorney general, what's happening with him? I hear staff is walking. They've accused him of bribery and all kinds of things. Just give me a quick update.
You know, isn't it unbelievable? This is 2020, Arnie. The top staff, not just some top staffers, but the seven top officials in the attorney general's office on Saturday, this letter came out. They had signed this letter and quit the office and said that the attorney general, Ken Paxton, is guilty of bribery, abuse of office, and other potential crimes. Only in this crazy year would that not register at all. And it's the last thing that we're talking about, right? It's instead of the first thing, no national attention for this, but it is an important story and it does have implications going forward. If he has to resign, the attorney general has indicated he's not going to quit. But as you mentioned, he's already under indictment for other things. He was accused of securities violations more than 5 years ago. Those criminal charges, felony charges, are still pending in court. Lots of problems piling up, but let me tell you, this is the rot within the majority party in Texas, that they have allowed this person to be in, you know, top law enforcement in the state of Texas. Now he's defending himself against bribery charges.
Well, Scott Burke, I have to let you go, but I want to add an exclamation point to this conversation about your attorney general, and that is he also wears another hat. He is the co-chair of Lawyers for Trump. He is the co-chair of Lawyers for Trump. So as we talk about the guy who was indicted 5 years ago, as we talk about his senior staff leaving him because of bribery, resigning, I just want to actually add that to his bio, because I think this is really important. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He is the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. If it is Friday, it must be Braddock. We will schmooze next week. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Arnie. Talk soon.
All right. Stick around, everyone. We'll be right back.
Having Fun with the Orchestra by Len Spencer, Columbia Records.
Though he was son to a political activist and a penmanship expert, Len Spencer still knew how to have a little fun. You're on The Soundbeat. You're listening to Having Fun with the Orchestra, a novelty cylinder recording from 1902. It's an example of a burlesque. Not the burlesque with dancing girls and feather boas and such. More outrageous than simple parody, burlesque was intended to mock conventions and genres by presenting serious subject matter with not-so-serious performance. And what better place than the usually staid and straightforward world of orchestral performance? Here's Len Spencer from 1902.
Hey, are you crazy?
Oh, I don't know.
Well, you're way off your base.
Well, then, what you ask me to sing for?
Why, that's the only way to make you stop talking.
Is that so? Why, hello, Klausmeier. Go away and let your sleep all wake up. Wake up, wake up.
For more about Len Spencer, one of the first stars of American recording, go to soundbeat.org. Soundbeat is produced at the Belfer Audio Archive, Syracuse University Library. I'm Brett Barry.
Insight Daily Radio. Their names are familiar to anyone who grew up on California rock. Guitarist Danny Kortchmar and Waddy Wachtel, bassist Leland Sklar, and drummer Russ Kunkel contributed to countless albums by James Taylor, Jackson Browne, Linda Ronstadt, among many others. Calling themselves the Immediate Family, the band, which also includes guitarist Steve Postel, will be releasing their debut album, an EP, and singles over the coming months. We spoke with bassist Leland Sklar about this new project.
Yeah, and when we hit the road, it was so great. I mean, it's just so great to be on stage and not be looking at the back of like James Taylor or Jackson Browne or, you know, whoever, but to actually see us on the stage. And I do pinch myself over it. It's something that I've always longed for. I mean, when we had the section together back in the early 70s, through the 70s, it was one of those things that was so enjoyable and so fulfilling. And then to have, you know, this many years later, have something that is an element of that. It's a different lineup and a different kind of music, but still it's the same emotional attraction of being with your, you know, it's a perfectly named group to be called the Immediate Family, because we really are an immediate family to each other. We're all like best friends and stuff. So it's a pinch yourself moment, which is also always nice to have a pinch yourself moment.
Bassist Leland Sklar on his new band Immediate Family, whose newest single Slippin' and Slidin' has just been released on Quarto Valley Records. Insight Daily Radio.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Every other week, we grab Bill Curry. Bill Curry ran for the governorship of Connecticut twice. He was an advisor to Bill Clinton. He is a progressive writer. He's a progressive thinker. He is someone that we turn to on a regular basis, in part to help us sort of figure out what's going on, because the chaos makes it very difficult and very dense to even figure out where you are as we're racing into this election. But more importantly, I'm really glad that we're grabbing Bill Curry, because the only debate between the two VP candidates, Pence being the VP and Kamala Harris hoping to become the first female Black vice president in American history, debated last night. Bill, I watched the debate, and as I said to Scott Braddock, having done conservative talk radio for most of my life and having been on a lot of conservative talk radio shows, Pence was the most predictable human being I've ever met. It's almost like it's a cookie cutter. And they all have to fit into this cookie cutter. They don't play by rules. They drone on. They pontificate. They lie. Like, their lying is to perfection. And they never answer a question. I mean, that was the essence of Mike Pence. And he performed exactly as I expected. Sadly, Kamala also performed as I was told to expect. That doesn't mean I was happy. But that means that she was effective, from what the consultant said, would basically help the ticket and help Joe Biden. That's what consultants say. What does Bill Curry say?
I would say, first of all, the only person whose reputation came out enhanced from the debate was that fly. The fly is probably getting an agent and hiring a publicist this morning. As for the human beings involved, you know, first of all, Kamala Harris won, and she'd be the way better vice president, and this is over, we can move on to the next thing. But as we try to, you know, take the lessons from it. I thought, by the way, Susan Page made Chris Wallace look like the greatest moderator in history. She had a much smaller challenge in curbing Pence than Wallace did in curbing Trump. But while there were less fireworks, she did an even worse job. I mean, Pence just went over and never answered a question. I'm somewhat of a broken needle on this, I understand, but it's sort of my critique of the Democratic Party itself. One, you have to refute every lie. You have to come prepared. Pence just told a bunch of whoppers, and you have to stop. There's a line, I know it's difficult, and it's difficult for a Black person, difficult for a woman, therefore doubly difficult for a Black woman, all the confounding expectations. And nonetheless, you turn around and you say, that's not true. It's what happens to everyone who works with Donald Trump. You right. get sucked into his net of lies.
Right.
And I won't let you stand here and say things about a pandemic or a failing economy that are untrue when we're trying so hard to fight our way out of both as a people. And he had so many obvious tricks like that. The second thing is to call out the process. And her, you have to just stop and turn the page at some point and say, this is what democracy requires. It requires civil discussion. It requires a set of rules. They call it the marketplace of ideas. And it's regulated by a certain set of rules, just like any other marketplace. And the rules are that when you're asked a question, you answer it. And if you don't, the moderator follows up. When your time is up, you stop talking, that you don't interrupt the other person. This is how we have a democracy. This is how we discuss our future. This is how we make big choices. Calling it all out. One, because the moment demanded it. And two, because these debates are so representative. Both the insane one and the relatively sane one had all the same defects. And they are the defects of all political discourse in America right now. Mm-hmm. So calling out is a big public service. And the third thing is, one of the reasons I wasn't a big Kamala Harris fan. I'm rooting for her now, and I'm hoping for the best in all the years to come, but especially on November 3rd. You know, she doesn't do policy very well. It's why she never figured out what her health care plan was. Biggest issue in America. We've all been talking about it for 30 years, you know, and she's been an AG in a state where AGs in California, going back to Garamondi, had a big influence on this issue. And she's a U.S. senator, and she's been a presidential candidate. And she still got to the end of the primary races and finally got a lobbyist to help draft a plan and was stunned when everyone hated it left and right and had to drop it. When she asked Biden about the busing stuff, you know, and hadn't remembered to ask herself what her own position was. And it hurt her a lot when she was embarrassed and had to say, I guess Joe and I do have the same position. And so I look at her, she's smart and she's personable and she's clearly, you know, she's a horse, you know, from political, you know, this is a real horse. This is somebody you can ride across the finish line and come in first. I get it. I get that she has those. But it, like my party as a whole, the facts are on our side. The great policy debates over the distribution of power and wealth and income in this country, the public's with us. We're actually pretty well united on those things. So make sure you've done all your homework. And you're prepared to come and argue the facts and the logic of your case as concretely and specifically as possible. We've got to be better at that. In our endless pursuit of the perfect message, slogan, meme, we are forfeiting what our greatest advantage is, which is that our policies work and theirs don't, and people agree with us and not them.
I'm really glad that you sort of talked a little bit about this, because the mantra of Kamala last night was, I am speaking, to sort of shut down Pence. But you made a better point, and that is, I play by the rules. Yeah. You're not. It's not that I am speaking. And she was. But the interruption was a violation of the rules. Droning on for minutes and not answering the question was a violation of the rules. And what I would have basically looked at Mike Pence and said, I don't know how you were raised, but I was raised by parents that said, even when you disagree, you have to at least acknowledge the rules and play by the rules. Eventually, when you have the power, you may be able to change them. But this is how we run schools, how we run faith, how we run government, how we run Wall Street. We play by the rules. The problem with this administration is the rules never apply to you. And that is what has hurt this economy. And that is why we are suffering with this pandemic.
And not only that, but I had the same thought watching Biden the other night, and that is, in addition to the question about the rules, this is the question that goes to the very heart of what is evil about this administration. That's the line. And you just turn and you say, you gave your word that you would come here.
Right.
And exactly. You would do this fairly and according to the rules we agreed on.
Right.
Our two campaigns met many times before tonight. And we agreed that we were going to answer the questions, stick to 2 minutes, not do the interrupting. And you're doing all of it. And that's the problem. That's why America has lost its place in the world, because no one takes Donald Trump's word for anything.
Right.
That's why you're losing this election right now, because no one believes what you say. That's one of the reasons our pandemic response is in the toilet, because everybody knows you're lying about it. You're lying about a pandemic. So when you come here tonight and you disregard all the rules you agreed with, you looked us in the eye and you said yes. Now stick to your word for one.
And that's so generic, but it plays well with so many people. And I think
because it's true.
Because it's true, exactly, yeah. Because it's true. I want to actually shift to a part of the Q&A last night because it actually gets to the bigger story. You talk about climate change a lot. You say climate change is the most important issue going forward. When they brought up the issue of climate change, his answer, which is Donald Trump's answer, is they didn't rake enough in California and we have clean air and clean water. That's the answer. He doesn't answer climate change. He doesn't really address what's happening. And what I actually wanted Kamala to say about the clean air is I'm just going to say, try to breathe in California. What are you breathing in California? Not only is the air not clean, not only has the fire polluted everything, but because of the pandemic, it has made those people even more vulnerable to what is happening as a result of climate change. And then you want to talk about clean water? Let's talk about the floods in Houston and the floods in Louisiana. There's a lot of water there. I'm not sure they'd call it clean, but what they basically know is they're drowning and it's flooding them out, and the farmers in Iowa don't have fields anymore from all that water. Use his answer against him.
There were so many moments where I was just waiting for, we were all told that she was going to be a great debater. People in the Democratic Party were expecting her to overwhelm Pence for a long time, and that didn't happen. I criticize in order for us to understand what's happening here. In every respect, she outshone him.
Absolutely.
The whole thing about, you should rake more. He said he talked to some Scandinavian president who said that's what they do with their forest cities. And the president immediately came out and said, I never said that. But more quickly for the purposes of a venue like that, 53% of the forests in California are controlled by the federal government, 3% by the state government. You don't rake the federal lands. Okay? You don't do that. So instead of telling Gavin Newsom to rake the 3%, if you really think that's the answer, if you're really uninformed enough to think that's the nature of the problem, why don't you rake your almost 20 times larger tract of land? That's where the problem is.
Right.
Number one. And number two, you say you're going to follow the science. Your teammate was just out in California telling the experts there that the scientists don't know, that you're not following the science. Right. Your official position is that the scientists don't know about the pandemic and they don't know about climate change. And you're doing the same thing with both, looking for scapegoats, peddling conspiracy theories, ducking responsibility. Pence said that we have no more frequent storms now than we did then. One, not true. Two, the storms are humongous. Everybody knows. We're not talking about computer models predicting the future like we were 20 years ago. We're talking about looking out your window and seeing what's happening. It's all there in bas relief, and it's coming for us. So anyway, we have to be more ready. My frustration watching, I thought, good job. I feel better and better about this election. As long as we do the work of turnout, I believe we're going to be okay. I believe we can take the Senate. I can see Harris's many talents. She's a much more honest and well-informed person than Pence. We can't let them get away with that much. Right. And we have to come better prepared to argue the case for the policies in which we believe.
Well, I sent you an article that I posted on Facebook as well about the fires in California, because it's so off the radar because of voter suppression, because of the Supreme Court, because of Donald Trump, getting COVID, because now 34 people within his immediate administration now all have COVID, so he clearly is a super spreader. There was a wonderful story about the California wildfires and about the fact that what's happening in 2020, with the choking smoke that's blanketing the West Coast. This is the line that blew my head. If you don't like all of the climate disasters happening in 2020, I have some bad news for you about the rest of your life. This is Texas A&M, everyone. This is a professor from Texas A&M. I saw that line, and that line terrified me because, again, we are not focusing on it. That's another reason why you can't have Donald Trump win again, because this will only exacerbate what we already know is a very challenging, if not frightening, future.
Well, the good news here is that it certainly appears that enough of Americans have decided to fire this guy.
Yeah.
That we have two things to work on. One is voter turnout, and the other is what we're going to do if he tries to steal this thing. Excuse me, I misspoke. What we're going to do when he tries to steal this thing. And there are lots of things. Luckily, it's the states that certify the results to the Senate, which will probably be Democratic by the time they're brought in on the 20th. I do not trust the courts in this country anymore. I know that it sounds I don't know, radical or conspiratorial when I say this, but the Republicans have managed to pack the courts now with so many extremists and political apparatchiks that we can no longer depend upon them to try to approximate a just interpretation of the rule of law. It's another thing, by the way, again, there are too many fancy tactics that the consultants and pollsters of this world tell their Democratic clients to do. Answer the court packing. This is beginning to remind me of Elizabeth Warren not saying how she would pay for the health care plan, and it really hurt her so much.
It hurt her.
And there's nothing, turn and sound, excuse me, this is, about just say two things. One, every time they say we're extremists, you're in bed with fascists. You're in bed with skinheads. Your party has been taken over by a global neo-fascist movement. And you're accusing Joe Biden of being an extremist? Are you out of your minds? But think of how they've perpetrated this optical illusion on the American people. I mean, there really is, this has been a long discussion of whether the Democrats have been taken over by socialists as opposed to whether the Republicans have been taken over by fascists.
So answer the question for me. So one of the things that they said is she did not answer the question about quote-unquote court packing. But in a way, I thought it was a very clever answer. I thought her answer was, when you look at the Circuit Court of Appeals, that he made 50 appointments, and of the 50 appointments, every one of them was white. Okay? Every one of them. And what I think a lot of people don't understand is that most cases never get to the Supremes. The real Supreme Court for most people in this country is the Court of Appeals. They don't know that, Bill Curry.
I agree with everything you just said, but I would just add this. And not just on a racial level, that is certainly an important dimension and worth bringing up. The bottom line is, you can just turn to him and say, you're packing the court right now.
Exactly.
Okay? You've spent the last 10 years packing the court. And just like this extremist argument, you know, that's what you're doing now. I can tell you, I can't speak for soon-to-be President Biden. I know that if you were to do what the American people did, which is allow whichever one of us wins this election to appoint this judge, if you agree to step back from your court packing, I can guarantee you there won't be any court packing on our part.
Exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
Let's have an armistice on the whole thing. You denied a president his ability, and it's worth even stopping to help the American people understand something slightly subtler. Since George Herbert Walker Bush began appointing extremists like Clarence Thomas, we've had presidents, especially with Trump and with George W. Bush, we've had presidents who I don't think were legitimately elected. In any case, got fewer votes than their opponent, doing the opposite of what we've always done, which is, you know, what Bill Clinton, a majority of Bill Clinton's federal district court nominees were former prosecutors, who by definition are not Trotskyites, okay? They're prosecutors.
Right.
And because Clinton knew, he wanted to find a center. He wanted them to be Democrats, he wanted them to be a little liberal, but he wanted them to be real jurists, and he wanted to find a center because he knew that's what a divided country needed. And I was there. That's what we did.
Right.
And these people have taken, these two presidents elected by a minority of voters, and in each case, I think, illegally, appointed nothing but the most extreme people and tried to clog up the system so a rightfully elected president couldn't make his nominees. That's what they're so proud of. That's what they advertise every day. Mm-hmm. And so if you had simply just decided to have conservatives, but not justices who would inflame the divisions of our country and act as your spear carriers, we wouldn't be in this jam.
You need to write a piece about the court packing and remind everyone that they have been court packing. And use that idea of they're packing the court with Amy. I mean, that's exactly what they're doing. They're abusing the rules. They're not playing by the rules they established. And if you didn't do this, look what we would get.
Right. We've had 12 years of court packing.
Right.
I don't mind, you know, in the years in which I was practicing law, I didn't mind going into a court knowing there was a Republican judge on the bench. I was confident in the rule of law, in the quality of their professionalism and their devotion to the best jurisprudence they could imagine. I knew I'd lose some points, but I knew it was a fair system. I don't know that anymore.
Yeah.
I don't know that anymore.
What about the potential for a new stimulus bill? We know that Donald Trump said yes, then he said no. Now he's worried about the airlines. Now he wants to send a check for $1,200 that he can sign just before the election, basically almost as if he's buying the votes.
Which is a felony, by the way, but sure.
What do you think is going to happen? I think Wall Street is going to look at Donald Trump with a jaundiced eye and say, you better come up with a stimulus package now. Because the only one he listens to, he doesn't listen to his staff, he doesn't listen to his wife, he doesn't listen to anyone, but Wall Street he pays attention to.
Let me say, he has been more faithful to Wall Street than to any of the others you just named. I get that that gets his attention, although I don't think there's anybody or anything he doesn't think he can con. It's one of those things, there's a part of me that doesn't want to bail out Trump politically, but there's a bigger part of me that wants to bail out the country economically by far. And so I hope we get whatever we can get passed and done. This morning, on Thursday morning, the president said he wasn't going to go to the next debate because it's virtual. He just thinks it's a waste of time. It's not a real debate. So he's out. And I thought, wow, it's just like the stimulus discussion. He's out of his mind. You want to be the guy that walked from the debate? You want to be the guy that walked from the stimulus talks? This is a deranged guy, further deranged by the steroids he's on. That is a likely explanation. All of his decisions now, from the rawest calculus of self-interest, are horrible. Yeah. He just gets up every day and sticks a shiv in his own spleen, you know? I've never seen such a tableau of someone running against himself. I think that there should be a stimulus package as broad as possible, as soon as possible. That's what the country needs.
Okay, so let me just ask a question about the airlines, because I was listening to a woman who was representing one of the unions involved with the airlines. And she reminded us of something that I'd kind of forgotten. And she said, can I tell you how a lot of mail gets moved around this country? In the belly of our planes.
Yeah.
And if you decide to have fewer planes, your mail is going to be delayed. In fact, I'm not sure how your mail is going to get there. What is so interesting to me is I'm like, will Donald Trump be listening to that? Because he's going, well, there's no way I'm bailing out the airlines, because he doesn't want any kind of a result on election day. He doesn't want votes to get in on time. But I thought that was such an interesting conversation, because I know everyone's concerned about the post office and getting, you know, the mail in a timely fashion. But she brought something up that I'm pretty sure she's accurate, but that really hasn't even been part of the conversation.
No question about it. Again, watching what he's done with the post office. And by the way, to all of my friends who ever use the phrase going postal, or who've participated in the mockery of an institution that enables me to stick a letter in my own mailbox, put the flag up, and have it delivered in California 2 days later, it's amazing how well they have kept up the quality of their work under the circumstances they've been subjected to. But when you take the post office and the Justice Department, Trump is so obviously subverting the fundamental instruments of government to ensure his own reelection. I think he'll fail at it, but he's doing it so baldly in front of us all. It's a frightening thing.
And last but not least, I'm going to throw something else out at you. And that is that I've been listening to all the police unions that have endorsed Donald Trump. I'm listening to them. And of course I say, you know, he's going to be there to support us. He's going to be there. And so I posted something on Facebook and I wrote, to the police unions that have endorsed Donald Trump, the candidate who is actually defunding the police is Trump.
Right.
Take that to the bank. But that is the irony. Part of the purpose of the stimulus is to support state and local government with additional aid. Who the hell do you think is paying the salaries of the police? Who is defunding them is Donald Trump.
And remember the theme here, okay? So the argument over which party is being taken over by extremists, people are saying that it's the party that was taken over by Joe Biden and not the party that's been taken over by Nazi skinheads. And you can just sort of, what's the deal on court packing? We've just endured 12 years of it from the Republicans. Right. And now they want us to promise not to do it when we take power. It's the same with this issue. So we just have to be ready to make these arguments clearly so that people understand.
This one to me is so obvious because Donald Trump has basically, and Mitch McConnell have refused to basically add another stimulus. Everyone thinks the stimulus is only about small business or people that are online waiting for food or, you know, hospital workers. I want to go to the cops with, like, you know, and just scream at them and go, excuse me, you are being defunded. Right. Understand what he is doing. Because if he doesn't do this now, it will only get worse, Bill. The hemorrhaging will only get worse, and they are on the payroll. And guess what? When that payroll dries up, so does their job, so does their stability. That is who is defunding
you. The people, for all their complaining about Obama, and again, I wish we would make sure every time we spoke that we added that Obama created more jobs in his last 3 years than Trump has produced in his administration, that we had better economic growth. The fact of the matter is that the party that voted against the Obama stimulus, without which there truly would have been a little hope of coming out, is the party that's now purposefully dragging its feet on this stimulus.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's the same. Nothing changes.
And on that note, I need to go because I have to adapt my show for the time. Bill Curry, thank you so much for joining us. I truly appreciate it. Bill Curry, former advisor to Bill Clinton, former candidate for governor in Connecticut, and just an incredibly thoughtful, progressive writer and thinker. Thank you again.
Take care.
All right. This is The Attitude, the Friday edition with Stephanie Collins and Dave Scott. They're my fabulous producers. We'll schmooze next week. Ciao. You bet.